Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Scientist Mark Linus was an active leader in Britain's anti-GMO movement until he changed his mind.
The way that eggplant's grown in Bangladesh, and it's a really important vegetable, very, very important part of the food culture there, is that it's very heavily dependent on pesticides, and some really toxic chemicals are sprayed conventionally on the crop. So this is a real problem, how to reduce the pesticides exposure. And using the GMO version doesn't require any of these pesticides because it's able to resist the pest, which is mainly what's being sprayed for. So all told, this should be a good news story, and yet you've got all these environmental groups who are opposing it because it's the so-called GMO, even though the net effect is to dramatically slash pesticide applications.
A look at one activist's rethinking of a complex issue and lots more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Wrapping your head around difficult subjects is challenging. Take the issue of GMOs, genetically modified organisms, and their role in our food today. Points of view and discussions are rampant, and what seems like a simple yes or no take on the surface becomes far from simple the deeper you dig. Many voices need to be heard here. Which brings me to the op-ed article that I came across in the New York Times. It was about the pro side of the GMO debate. The author, Mark Linus, had been a founding father of Britain's anti-GMO movement. Now he writes and speaks extensively about climate change and agriculture. His op-ed piece was called How I Got Converted to GMOs. Mark is a visiting fellow at Cornell University's Office of International Programs at the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. Mark, welcome.
Thank you very much.
That's quite a mouthful.
What's quite a mouthful? The
the title of the article.
Oh, no, I agree. And as a writer, you don't get to choose the headline, so that wasn't my choice of words. And I would be uncomfortable, actually, about using the word converted, because it's not as if I had some kind of religious epiphany. It was an evidence-based change of mind, which took some time to play out, and based really on my reading of a changing situation. So I changed my mind really because, as I saw it, the circumstances had really changed.
Well, let's start with the article, because you visited a farmer in Bangladesh. And tell us what happened there.
Right. And this was part of my work with the Cornell Alliance for Science, in fact. So Cornell University is involved in deploying a GMO eggplant in Bangladesh under the auspices of a government agricultural institute there. And this is a really interesting example of how GMOs can be used in a way which improves the lives of poorer farmers and improves also the environment, because the way that eggplant's grown in Bangladesh, and it's a really important vegetable, very, very important part of the food culture there, is that it's very heavily dependent on pesticides, and some really toxic chemicals are sprayed conventionally on the crop. You wouldn't believe it. I mean, you see these farmers out in the fields every single morning and every single evening spraying. So they're doing it every day. They're suffering from chronic health impacts because of the amount of pesticides that are being used in the fields. And of course, there's the residues that consumers have to worry about too in Bangladesh. So this is a real problem, how to reduce the pesticides exposure. And using the GMO version doesn't require any of these pesticides because it's able to resist the pest, which is mainly what's being sprayed for. So this is good for the bottom line for the farmers because they have to spend less money on pesticides. It's better for their health because they're not being constantly poisoned. And of course, it's better for the wider environment because you don't get the pesticide runoff. So all told, this should be a good news story, and yet you've got all these environmental groups who are opposing it because it's a so-called GMO, even though the net effect is to dramatically slash pesticide applications. So it's just one of these, it really illustrates, in fact, how the debate has really played out in a way which is fundamentally irrational, I think.
Well, you talk about other countries that have banned GMOs. Has Bangladesh banned GMOs, and that this is an exception, an experiment, or is it a country that has accepted GMO?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because Bangladesh has, in fact, accepted this insect-resistant eggplant when it was banned effectively in India next door. And there was a moratorium imposed after a huge amount of lobbying by anti-GMO activists, I think, back in 2010. And Greenpeace managed to stop it also in the Philippines. So both of those countries are still heavily dependent on pesticide because the GMO version hasn't been able to go forward. So Bangladesh is an exception in this, and it's a very important case study, potentially even a tipping point, because this is the world's first developing country GMO food crop, if you like, specifically out there now with farmers. Farmers are saving their seed. They entirely control the technology and how it's deployed, and it's now being sold into the market. So it's really going directly now into the food supply and hopefully improving the situation there.
Well, I want to go back for a moment. You were opposed to GMOs for a very long time. You worked as an environmentalist against GMOs. What was the path here to bring you to these conclusions?
Well, this was at the beginning of the whole GMO debate in about 1995, 96, where I got heavily involved in campaigning against the technology. And I was one of the earlier members of the anti-GMO movement in the UK. I personally organized a targeting of Monsanto's offices in England. I used to participate in vandalisms against field trials of genetically modified crops. And, you know, I did media interviews and I participated quite heavily in campaigning against this technology and helped sort of export it to other countries as well. I mean, I think to some extent what happened in the UK back then was sort of the epicenter of the campaign, and things snowballed out from there. And, you know, it was one of those campaigns which changed the world. I mean, probably the majority of people since then have been led to believe that there's something wrong with GM technology a priori, if you like, and that was really an outcome of the campaigning that we were all involved in back at that point.
So what changed your mind?
Well, like all of these things, it was a rather sort of convoluted path. It wasn't that I suddenly realized that I was wrong one morning when I woke up. It was really that I was involved in researching on climate change, as you mentioned at the beginning. So when I started work on that back in the year 2000, I was traveling around the world looking at the impacts of global warming. I was very concerned to be able to communicate this with some degree of scientific expertise and authority. So I spent a lot of time reading the scientific literature, looking at geophysics, glaciology, oceanography, all of these fascinating areas of science which really supported the whole agenda on climate change. And also, I spent a lot of time defending the fact that there was a scientific consensus that climate change is real. And so I really kind of had a self-taught scientific education, which took many years, and my books had a lot of scientific references. But at the same time, of course, the scientific community had more or less made its mind up that GM technology was both safe and very effective. And so I was in the position really where I was defending the science on climate change and almost denying the science on GM crops. And I felt that was really an impossible situation for me to be in as somebody who wanted to write about science and to do so with some degree of you know, informed authority.
But Mark, there's science on both sides of this issue. There are scientists who believe GMOs have difficulties. I mean, you know this and we've heard about this, but the environment, perhaps human health, effect on other plants, and then seeds that are designed by companies to market their products. So there's debate on both sides, and both sides have a level of validity to it. So sorting this out is not an easy thing to do.
It isn't, and that's why the concept of scientific consensus is so important, because I could, you know, roll off half a dozen names of scientists, credited scientists, who don't believe in climate change either, or who don't believe that HIV causes AIDS. So you will find scientists, generally small in number, who differ from the consensus on any issue you care to name. But the important thing is to understand that, well, thousands now of studies have been carried out which show that the safety issue in terms of human health or animal health impacts is essentially closed. There isn't a meaningful debate about that. And you can see this in statements from the major scientific institutions, so the American Association for the Advancement of Science, World Health Organization, the major academic institutions around the world have all come to a consensus which they state that that GM technology does not add any degree of risk which isn't already present in conventional plant breeding. But as maybe you were going on to say, this isn't all about science. The politics of this, who controls the technology, these aren't issues which are expressly scientific. They're more socioeconomic and political. And so that's a different kind of debate, I think.
Mark, thanks for sharing your point of view.
Thanks for having me.
Mark Linus is a visiting fellow at Cornell University's Office of International Programs at the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. He's also a member of the advisory board of the science advocacy group, Sense About Science. The best in taverns and tea rooms, fish shacks and VFWs, these are the places Jane and Michael Stern relentlessly track down and report on at roadfood.com and here. Jane, Michael, good to have you two back.
Hi, Lynn.
Hey, Lynn.
So where have you two been?
We've been in Florida, a little city called Eatonville, which is sort of in greater Orlando, but you would never find two towns more different than Orlando and Eatonville. Orlando, as you know, is chain restaurants and Disney World and, you know, everything that's plasticky and new. Eatonville is the home of Zora Neale Hurston, who is a phenomenal African-American writer. And there's a Zora Neale Hurston festival held in tiny little Eatonville every year. And Michael and I were there at the festival and around town checking out the probably 8 or 10 phenomenal soul food restaurants.
I just don't think of Florida and soul food. Which is, of course, how silly. You know, why not Florida and soul food?
But well, in fact, Eatonville was the very first municipality in the U.S. to be incorporated by families of emancipated slaves after the Civil War. So it goes way, way back. The soul food restaurants in Eatonville and in Orlando itself, actually, many of them go back decades and were probably some of the original soul food restaurants in the East, you know, except for maybe, you know, New York or Washington. But whatever. The fact is the food there is really good, really authentic, and really has a connection with history. I mean, some of them are second and third generation restaurants that are really delicious.
And in the best soul food tradition, you're welcome with open arms. I mean, it was gracious and charming, and we were fed better than I think we've eaten in the last year.
So what did you eat?
Well, for one thing, there is seafood. There's a great place actually in Eatonville run by a former mayor of Eatonville called Gordon's Be Back Fish House, because once you go there, you will be back for more. It's that good. And they have all kinds of seafood, always served with grits. The specialty there, of course, is mullet, you know, a real Florida treat. It's very rich, delicious, kind of oily seafood with a great crisp crust on it. I mean, the mullet is sensational. The grits are great. And for dessert, what you want is key lime cake. It's a layer cake with the same kind of balance of sweet tart flavors as you get in key lime pie, but a layer cake. And what's great about the cake is that it is as green as red velvet cake is red, really bright green.
I've never heard of a key lime cake.
We hadn't either, but every one of the soul food restaurants that we visited in Orlando, maybe 6 or 7 or 8 of them, had layer cakes for dessert, and they all had key lime cake as one of the choices.
Like three layers.
It's a regular layer cake, either 2 or 3 layers. And what's it? The icing itself is not key lime flavor. That's kind of a cream cheese type frosting. The cake itself has that key lime flavoring.
And it's wonderful. And the cakes, the soul food cakes that we had in Eatonville, I think they start at about 1.5 feet tall. I don't know how they get them so high, but they are major, gigantic cake.
Is there also the usual or the things we most associate of ribs and pulled pork and that kind of thing, a barbecue?
Absolutely, yes. And for that, you want to go to a place called the P&D Soul Food Kitchen in Orlando proper. It's a very new place, a kind of strip mall location, not that interesting from the outside. But inside, you get the ribs. You get absolutely sensational baked chicken. I mean, Sunday supper baked chicken to the nth degree, along with a choice from at least a dozen different fabulous soul food side dishes, you know, cook rutabagas, macaroni and cheese that is made with four different cheeses and baked with maybe a little sour cream in it to give it a twist. I mean, just side, you could make a whole meal of side dishes, but then you'd miss the chicken and ribs. So,
and also phenomenal red velvet cake, which the owner told us that most people buy and then they get so in love with the cake, they hide it under the bed until the guests leave, and then they can eat it all by themselves. Which I thought I invented that trick.
No, you didn't. Guys, thanks. Sounds really
bye,
good.
Bye-bye, Lynn.
You can find Jane and Michael's discoveries at roadfood.com, and you can make some soul food of your very own with Chef Terry Bryant's modern take on collard greens. Find his citrus collards with raisins on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, register for our monthly book giveaway. This month, in honor of our 20th, it's a signed copy of my baby, The Splendid Table. Get registered at splendidtable.org. Coming up, the Italian road less traveled on the Adriatic, and a long-lost vegetarian cookbook from Lithuania. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. I know Tuscany is the big draw in Italy, but Italy has 19 other regions, each with its own unique art, foods, wines, character, and characters. And this is why I like food and travel writer Adam Leith Gollner. He's a fan of the obscure, the undervalued, the choice places not overrun with folks like us, which, of course, are the very spots we want to be. His recent piece in Savour reveals an Italian region with all the qualifications, and the food is pretty sensational as well. Adam, welcome. Good to have you back.
It's great to be back.
So you picked Abruzzo as a place to explore. Most people have not heard of Abruzzo, and, you know, it's not the most famous part of Italy. So what's the draw?
Isn't it crazy that it's just an hour and a half away from Rome, and it's this agricultural breadbasket, and it's famous for all sorts of dishes and all sorts of cheeses and cold cuts and meats and wines and truffles and wild mushrooms, and yet nobody goes there. It just seemed like it was hidden in plain sight. I mean, it's this place that has remained pristine, and it has tons of wildlife and nature preserves. A third of its territory is in fact national parks and wildlife preserves, and they call it the greenest region in Europe, which you can really tell when you're driving through it. It's just all these wild places, and that's a great thing for somebody who wants to travel there today.
It sounds great. There's something I realized when I did a lot of exploring in Italy, and true of anywhere you go. If you're really looking to get the true feel of a place and truly understand it, the greatest thing that you can do is find a key, find that person who understands that place right down to the fiber of their being. Mm-hmm. And I understand you found such a person. Who was it?
The Baron Luigi Cataldi Madonna is a winemaker whose family has been making wine on the plain of Ofena, which is about an hour away from the coast, the Adriatic coast. His family's been making wine there since time immemorial. And he was this wonderful character who had an incredible sense of style. The way he dressed was just, you know, Italian men are so stylish sometimes. Oh, yeah. And he had this, you know, he greeted us with a glass of his Cerasuolo, which is what they call their rosé wine or rosato wine. It's not exactly rosé. It's more, it looks like cherry juice. And in fact, the Cerasuolo is a reference to that cherry hue. And so he came out with this incredible, you know, cherry-colored wine and a pastel blue sweater and yellow pants and Ray-Ban sunglasses and had this gravelly voice and just had this incredible laugh. And he said, you know, the road that brought you here is very similar to the road that shepherds would have taken over centuries as they were enacting the rites of the transumanza. And he said, that's everything. He said, that's everything to Abruzzo. If you want to understand this place, everything we do comes back to the seasonal movement of herds and flocks of sheep and goat up and down the mountains. And the second he said that, it was like, oh, okay, that's what we came here to learn.
I understand that path, which is thousands of years old, mm-hmm. is this wide, wide swath, and it goes through forests and plains mm-hmm. from north to south.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it goes all the way down to the coast. It goes to Puglia. It goes up into the mountains, and it's about moving the sheep through areas where they can graze. It's a nomadic, itinerant kind of lifestyle, and what we set out to do is kind of, I guess, echo that in a road trip.
What about the food? Tell me about some of the dishes.
Okay, my favorite meals by far were the ones that we had at Emidio Pepe Winery. And Emidio Pepe is still alive. He's in his 80s, and he's still very much active in the vines, as are his daughters and his granddaughters. So there are three generations of Pepe, mm-hmm. mainly women. I don't know if he has any sons. I think he's got three daughters, and then they all have more daughters. So there's just many women there. But at the head of all of this is Rosa, his wife. And she is the classic archetypal Italian grandma who spends all of her time cooking food for this large family and just wants you to eat it and wants you to and, you know, even when you're full, she says, oh, well, the main dishes haven't even come out yet. And and she has this incredible garden, and everything they make is very natural. One of the things that makes the Emidio Pepe Winery so special is their emphasis on the fact that they've always been without any chemicals, and they never used pesticides or fertilizers. And, you know, they have their hens out back, and then the guy who, you know, the shepherd who brings them lamb, and then the wild game that comes in from the hunters. And they have this little agriturismo where you can stay for 40 euros a night, which is probably the best deal in the universe. And if you want, you can also contact them and ask about getting on a meal plan, which I would highly recommend, because that way you can taste some of the wines from the winery and see how they pair those wines with their regional foods, mm-hmm. their specialties. And so all of which is bringing me to this one dish that she made that blew my mind, because it really was what Abruzzo is all about. It. And what it was something called mazzarelle. And when they'd been speaking about it, I thought they were saying mozzarella. And I wasn't, you know, okay, great, fresh mozzarella sounds great. But it's not mozzarella, it's mazzarelle. And what it is it's kind of like these large lettuce leaves that they fill with lamb offal. So with little slivers of heart and liver and lung of lamb. Ah. And with a little sliver of carrot and a little sliver of onion and a little sliver of garlic and a sprig of parsley and some oregano. And then they wrap them up like vine leaves and tie them together with a neat bow made from lamb intestine.
Huh.
And then they braise that in their white wine for like 2 or 3 hours with a little olive oil, and then add more water if it starts drying out. And I remember thinking, okay, there's no way this is going to be good. There's no way that lamb lung wrapped in lettuce leaf and tied together with lamb intestine could be anything other than what it looks like, which is not that appetizing. But then when she brought it out, it was like, oh, they'd kind of transformed and they shrunk and they looked like dolmas, like really looked like that. And the taste was astonishing. I was like, whoa, this is a secret that the world needs to know. This is a triumph, you know. And I remember I came home and I told some chefs who were friends of mine about it, and they were so excited that they tried it out. But of course, they weren't able to really replicate it. It's hard, you know, you need to know how to do it. And she knew how to do it. And yeah, it was
and
just
she'd probably
amazing.
Been doing it since she was a girl.
She had been. I'll add one little thing here. While she was showing us how to make it, she was also showing her granddaughter, Chiara, how to make it. And she said to Chiara, she said, you know, this is one of the three dishes that you're going to need to master if you want to get married. In our family, this is the thing that gets you your husband. And when I tasted it, I was like, I can see why.
Adam, thank you. What a trip.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Adam Leith-Gollner is contributing editor of Savour Now, you can find his Abruzzo article in the May 2015 issue of the magazine. Find Savor's recipe for porchetta-style chicken at splendidtable.org. And to learn more about Abruzzo, check out the book by the late Italian food expert who grew up there, Anna Teresa Callan. She wrote Food and Memories of Abruzzo. Holding an unassuming jar of baby food, it might seem hard to imagine that a simple container of pureed carrots could have such a profound role in shaping our cultural values and the ideas of nutrition. Amy Bentley explores the subjects of food, politics, and culture from many angles, and in her latest work, she looks at baby food with her book, Inventing Baby Food, Taste, Health, and the Industrialization of the American Diet. Our contributor, Noelle Carter, got the story.
Hi, Amy. I'm so excited to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for inviting me.
I'm wondering, what did we do before commercial baby food? How did babies eat, and when did mothers introduce their babies to solid food?
Well, commercial baby food started in the early 20th century, 1920s, late 1920s. Before then, there wasn't a category specifically called baby food. There was a category of soft foods, that is, foods that were appropriate for infants, invalids, and the elderly. But the advice and practice of the late 19th century was really that you didn't feed babies solid food until about a year of age. You were supposed to breastfeed them, formulas if you absolutely had to. But it was thought that solid food wasn't needed until later. And in fact, there was an advice and practice that you did not feed children fruits and vegetables until about 2 years of age.
Now, how did commercial baby food come to be?
Well, as vitamins were discovered in the 19-teens, that was also about the time you had the industrialization of the food supply. Those products were more widely available and were more affordable. There was a man named Harold Clapp in Rochester, New York, whose child was sick, and he created a soup for that child made of vegetables, and it proved so popular that his friends asked him for it, and he went to the local canner and commercially prepared this product. That was also about the same time that the Gerber Company was starting to produce baby food, and others just picked it up, and then eventually you had the development of three or four really big commercial brands. But it was very, very popular from the get-go. The products were portable, convenient. They were advertised as safe and modern and better than you could prepare at home, and they were seen as a product of convenience for women. Women could put them in their bags and remove themselves from the kitchen and travel around, and eventually made it easier for them to go outside and perform paid labor because they had this portable baby food.
You go through the history of baby food, and it's incredibly popular until the 1970s. And then all of a sudden, the use of baby food and a number of other things come into question. What happened?
Well, through the mid-20th century, the average age of when it was understood you could feed a baby solids begins to drop dramatically. So whereas in the early 20th century, the average age of feeding an infant is around 9 to 12 months of age, by the 1950s and 60s, the average age of introducing solids to a baby is 4 to 6 weeks of age. And there are some doctors that are promoting introducing solids at 24 hours after birth. And this was because baby food was thought to be strong, healthy, solid food was better than liquid formula. Most parents formula fed their babies in the mid-20th century, and commercial solid food was just kind of the next step. There was no scientific evidence that this was harmful for a child. And in the kind of post-war, Cold War period, there was this idea that we need our children strong, we need them to be competitive. I might be doing my baby a disservice if I don't feed my child commercial baby food early. This begins to change in the 1970s and 80s as you switch and have a kind of a general ethos that's a little more mistrustful of science, mistrustful of institutions, skeptical of technology. And women start to ascribe to an ethos called natural motherhood. I should trust my instincts. I know better than anything how I should feed my baby. There begins to be some scientific evidence that it probably is not the best thing to feed an infant solids so early, in part because the way that baby food is made at that period, which is with a lot of additives, sugar, salt, and that also an infant's digestive system is not equipped to digest solid food. It's so early, and the best food is breast milk. Eventually, they figure it out. And so consumers push against the conventional baby food. They make their own baby food. The commercial manufacturers begin to take out sugar, salts, begin to remove baby food desserts. And then you have a different era of what baby food should be like and how I should feed my child and when I should feed my child baby food.
You discuss the connection between commercial baby food and the industrialized palate. How might food choices, be it baby food or even formula, play a role in developing a child's sense of taste?
Yeah, scientists are finding out that infants learn and grow and develop through taste, through their palates, even in utero. We know that amniotic fluid is flavored by the food a woman eats. After birth, the foods that a child is exposed to have a big influence on how that child is learning and developing and understanding about the world. And if children are only experiencing highly industrialized food products with milder profiles, more salt, more sugar, refined carbohydrates, then that's what their palate is becoming even more accustomed to. As humans, we're hardwired to seek out sugar and eventually salt, but we need to learn to become acclimated to bitter flavors, sour flavors, a variety of profiles. So there's more and more emphasis on first foods being something other than white rice cereal, for instance, you know, an avocado or meat or a red or a orange fruit or vegetable. And there's no real scientific evidence that these can't be used as first foods. In fact, if we look around the world, we find that people feed their infants a wide variety of different kinds of first foods, including some very interesting spice combinations.
Where do you see the trend in baby food going from here on out?
Yeah, it's really interesting. And in the last couple of decades, there's really been a rise of boutique baby foods who are experimenting with different flavors and different grains and vegetables. Commercial baby foods are also expanding their repertoire. There's also a group who understand that there wasn't a category called baby food in the beginning and maybe are arguing that there doesn't need to be a category called baby food. And this is a trend called baby-led weaning. And those people advocate that infants be breastfed until about 6 months of age, and then you can sit that child in a high chair and chop up table food and throw it on the high chair and the baby will be just fine. That said, I mean, baby food is not going to go away because it is important for some children. And also, it is a product of convenience. And in the United States, we're very much attuned to convenience and mobility. And these products allow women especially more flexibility with their life. And in fact, some studies show that they actually do provide a wider range of fruits and vegetables for infants than otherwise. You can buy a jar of mangoes or a jar of beets, and a lot of families don't have a very wide variety of fruits and vegetables. So once infants go off baby food, one of the top three vegetables that they consume are French fries. And so baby food can actually have a protective quality for a lot of American infants.
Amy, thank you so much. It's such a fascinating read.
You're welcome. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Amy Bentley is Associate Professor in NYU's Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health. She's author of Inventing Baby Food. Noelle Carter is the Los Angeles Times Test Kitchen Director and writes the Culinary SOS column. Check out our version of baby food with a recipe for celery root and apple puree. And you can find it at splendidtable.org. Coming up, your summer food questions. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. It's time for us to connect. You can get to us any way you'd like. Facebook, Twitter. Call us, 800-537-5252. Chris is on the line from Washington, D.C. Chris, welcome.
Hi, Lynn. Thanks for taking my call.
You are welcome. Thank you. What's on your mind?
Well, you know, summer's here.
Right.
And love to grill and cook outside. Have some great, you know, staples, you know, the regular, you know, your sausages and steaks and things like that.
Right.
That I like to make. But what I'd like to add into my repertoire, and I have not been very successful in doing as of yet, is fish on the grill.
And I would
like some ideas on types of fish and preparation, you know, something, you know, other than just like, you know, salt and pepper and throw it on the grill kind of thing.
Yeah.
Just a couple of, you know, go-to, you know, recipes that friends and family would really love.
Well, let me ask you this. Where have the problems come up with the fish?
It sticks.
Oh, yeah.
Or I don't exactly know when it's done.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Here's the deal. With fish, you're not cooking it the way you cook meat. In so many words, with meat, there's a lot of connective tissue that the heat has to break down so that we can actually chew this. And with fish, there's not that much of the connective tissue. What you're really doing is really just getting it hot to the middle and letting, letting all the protein cells and everything else firm up. And you want to do that really gently because it overcooks so easily. One of the rules with cooking fish is 10 minutes to the inch. So you measure the thickness of the fish and you figure you're going to cook it 10 minutes for every inch. What I do is I figure 8 minutes. You know, you can use a thermometer and all of that, but quite frankly, what I do is I make a very discreet cut at the thickest part of the fish, just a little slit with a knife, and I pull it apart a little bit with another knife, and I see if it is white to the bone. Not flaking, because that's overcooked, but just, you know how when you look at raw fish, it's almost sheer? You know what I mean? You know what it looks like raw. Well, when it's cooked, that turns opaque. You couldn't see through it anymore. You would never call it sheer. And you want it just at that point. And I always take it a little shy of that point because once you get it off the heat, it's going to continue cooking for a few moments. So use the basic idea of 10 minutes to the inch and then have your heat, have one part of your grill very low and one part of the grill at medium. You want to do this slow. Now, if you want to get a really great sear, what you do is have one part of the grill on higher heat, okay, like, you know, really hot, and always oil the grill generously once it's hot, okay? So, you know, a heat-proof brush of oil over the grill and on the fish. And then and make sure, well, we'll get to the type of fish in a minute. But the idea would be get a sear on the fish so you get a nice little bit of crispiness started. And then with two flat spatulas, the kind of things that you would flip pancakes with, scoop that under the fish and just transfer it to the part of the grill where the heat is very low or almost non-existent. And then cover the grill and let it cook for 8 minutes. Or let it cook for 4 minutes and go in and with those pancake turners gently flip it. So that's, and then as far as the fish that handle the easiest, you don't want fish that are super flaky. So for instance, as delicious as it is grilled, flounder is tricky. Cod can be tricky. Salmon, anything with a lot of oil in it, like salmon, mackerel, that kind of thing, is usually really easy because it can you can handle it. You know what I mean? And a steak is always easier to handle than a fillet because it's a bit thicker and more compact. And if you really want to cheat and have a fabulous meal while you're doing it, you can wrap it in foil. And you just do some sliced garlic and a bit of butter or olive oil on the bottom of the foil with any kind of fresh herb you like. Basil is one of my favorites, or a few branches of rosemary, okay? And then you can take the fillet or a whole fish, and you lay that on top of it, and then you put on top of the fillet or into the cavity of the fish more of the same seasonings, okay? Be careful with rosemary, too much of it in it. You think like you're, you know, you feel like you're eating a bush. But, you know, lemon, garlic, you could put a little bit of chili paste. It would be wonderful. You could do fresh lime and pineapple, which would be fabulous with a bit of butter. And then more on the top. And then you take the foil and you kind of crinkle it and seal it over the top of the fish. Leave like a little bit of an air pocket. And you can cook it on one side for 4 minutes and flip it and cook it on the other side for 4 minutes. And when you open it up, stand back. But I love to do it at the table, especially if I've got some big fillets. I take it to the table. I put it on a platter. And then I said, everybody lean back. And then I take a knife and I just go and slit it. And out comes this whoosh of aroma.
Mm.
Yeah.
I love the idea of the lime and pineapple. Those are two of my favorites.
Yeah, and it can be so good. A little ginger in there if you feel like it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can just play around with that a lot. One of the other combinations, soy sauce, ginger, sesame oil, and a little bit of vinegar. Rice vinegar or sweetened rice vinegar is really wonderful. And that can be a sauce on the table, but it can also be seasoning the fish.
Well, you've got lots of ideas. I'm going to start experimenting. Thank you so much. I
appreciate it. You are welcome. Have a seafood summer. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye, Chris.
Bye-bye.
Heather's on the line from Austin, Texas. Heather, what's on your mind?
Hi, Lynn. I've just made a batch of lemon balm jelly because the lemon balm in my garden was completely out of control.
I love lemon balm for that. It just, and the aroma is so fabulous.
Absolutely. I was a little worried it was going to go to seed and then it would be in the lawn. It's a really herbal jelly, kind of like mint jelly.
Right.
And I was wondering if maybe you had some suggestions on how I could use it in cooking, you know, other than just spreading it on toast or something like that.
Well, it's probably going to be really delicious with anything that's salty. You know, I'm thinking of ham, cured meats, sausages. It's probably also going to be fabulous with cheeses, especially cheeses that have some oomph to them, like cheddar or even a brie, for instance. You just want a little bit. You know, you'd spread just a thin film of the jelly on a hunk of bread or on a cracker and then plop that cheese on top of it. And, you know, now that I'm thinking about it, yeah, it'd be great with cheeses that have some strength to them, but it would also really be delicious on something like ricotta, which is creamy and, you know, very fresh. And then that lemon balm, the contrast would be lovely. So that's a couple of ways you could use it. You know, the other thing that might be interesting to do with it is if you're grilling something like salmon, because I'm thinking of something that has a fair amount of moisture and fat to it, to brush that lemon balm jelly onto it to give it a glaze toward the end of cooking.
Oh, that sounds fantastic.
Yeah, and then you could just then squeeze a tiny bit of lemon on it, which you might do anyway, to bring out that lemon flavor once you put it on the plate.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, grilling, something we're doing a lot because it's too hot to cook in the kitchen.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, this is kind of strange sounding, but those little new potatoes, those little red skin potatoes that are almost sweet, you know, when you get them really fresh dug, like at the farmer's market.
Sure.
I wonder what would happen if you steam them or boil them or even grill them and then toss them with a little bit of lemon jelly, a tad of vinegar, some black pepper and salt, and see what you get. Let it absorb a little. You know, it'd be kind of sweet and tart. And it'd have that lemony kind of feeling. Or you could do lemon jelly and lemon juice to give it a tart edge. And then coarse salt and fresh ground black pepper.
Oh, that sounds fantastic. We're going to have to give that a try.
You're going to have to make more lemon balm jelly also, I'm sorry to say. Happy to say.
Not a problem.
Okay. Hey, enjoy the lemon balm.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
If you have never tried to grow lemon balm, let me tell you, if you've got a little piece of dirt, it comes back every year, and it spreads beautifully, and it's a low-growing plant, and it has the most subtle, lovely taste of lemon. It's what I think of as a very elegant, classy herb. You know, this isn't a rock'em sock'em, rosemary, take-over-the-garden kind of aroma. This is very subtle, but you put some of those leaves under the skin of a chicken, or you make jelly with them, make a lemon balm tea, sauté them in a pan with some simple fish, anything that's very delicate and light, green beans, for instance. Anyway, it's a great herb to grow, and it's sort of, it can be halfway between a perfume and a and an edible herb. It has, and you, oh, dry the leaves in a big basket and just have them out all winter. And every time you walk past them, just crush them a little and you get that lovely scent of delicate lemon. So try lemon balm. And it's not too late to plant it, you know, especially if you live in an area that tends to be warmer, because it kind of comes up fairly quickly and then it just takes over and it'll really be abundant next year. Okay, 800-537-5252. That's how you can reach us. And you can check us out on Facebook and Twitter. In the 1930s, just before World War II, a woman by the name of Fania Lawando ran a popular restaurant in the town of Vilna, Lithuania. It not only served unusual food, vegetarian, kosher, it served as a salon of sorts for artists and intellectuals, including Marc Chagall. Fania wrote a cookbook based on those recipes. The cookbook would have been lost forever had it not been for Barbara Mazur and Wendy Waxman. They found an original copy of it in a rare book room at the YIVO Institute for Jewish Research. It took 6 years for them to get it published. The book, The Vilna Vegetarian Cookbook, is a peek into the cuisine and spirituality of pre-World War II Jewish life. Contributor Melissa Clark sat down with Barbara Mazur to hear about its unusual author, Fania Lawando.
Barbara, it's so nice to have you here.
Thank you.
So who is Fania Lawando, and how did you find her cookbook?
Fania Lawando was a cooking school teacher, a restaurateur, and a cookbook writer. In the 1930s, she lived in Vilna, which was part of Poland at the time. I belong to an organization called YIVO, Institute for Jewish Research, and as part of the book group, I was allowed to go into the rare book room, was shown a few books, one of which was this beautifully illustrated cookbook. I found out that it was written by a woman. She was a vegetarian, way ahead of her time, and I found out about all the other things in her life. But the book was in Yiddish, so we couldn't read it. And I contacted a friend, Wendy Waxman. I made her look at the book, and together we decided we were going to have the book translated, published, and give Fania Lawando a voice for the 21st century. She was way ahead of her time in her thinking.
So being a vegetarian in the 1930s in Eastern Europe was unusual. Was there any kind of burgeoning Jewish vegetarian movement at the time?
Well, there was, because the intelligentsia at that time in Vilna were trying to start a new life. It was about to be a wonderful, wonderful time for them. There were poets, writers, artists, and being a vegetarian at the time was thought to be very forward-thinking. First of all, it was a kindness to animals, and people thought that vegetables were better, and it wasn't necessary to have meat in the diet. Researchers felt if the peasants could eat vegetables because they didn't have money for meat, and they were very healthy, it was a good thing.
And was there other reasons also for the popularity of vegetarian cuisine at the time? I know when I was reading the book, you had mentioned something about kosher butchering being unavailable.
Well, for Jewish people, Polish government was outlawing kosher slaughterhouses. And so there wasn't much meat available. And that was Fania Lawando's strength. She took a vegetarian diet and made heads of the households feel that they were doing a good service for their families by serving vegetables. They were not depriving their families. Depriving their families would have been a more common thought at the time. But she didn't believe in that. She thought that it was good reason to be vegetarian and nature's bounty was available for everybody. And so it went.
And so she was very interested in it being good for the body, but also good spiritually. As a good Jew, you could also be a vegetarian, and it all went hand in hand together.
Right. Absolutely. There's no requirement to eat meat, but it was just something that was done for celebrations and for prosperity and for Shabbat. But she changed it around. She wrote that in every family, there are people who have allergies, children with delicate stomachs, and she was very interested in health, sanitation, hygiene, fresh, clean food, and this book is full of recipes.
Yeah, tell us about some of those recipes. The recipes seem very modern, actually. You know, you'd think that a book from the 30s would seem old-fashioned, but they really don't.
No, you know, I've been cooking from this book for, you know, the last few years, and it always amazes me that the salads are so delicious and brightened with some lemon juice and parsley and dill and a little bit of oil, and suddenly you have something in front of you that's beautiful, and you've just used a cucumber and a tomato. You have this beautiful thing. The same with the root vegetables. She uses them in soup. She uses them in stews and schnitzel. Mm-hmm. I find myself making the schnitzels over and over because it's a quick meal, and mm-hmm. I love the soups. I just made a delicious summer squash soup. I made a delicious beet soup. The beet soup, you just add a drop of sugar at the end, and it's just fabulous. And there's even a pickle soup, which is a surprise. Fania had a restaurant, and it was very popular. All of the poets and artists of Vilna used to come and eat there. Even Marc Chagall ate in her restaurant.
And she was quite an entrepreneur. So she had a restaurant, she had a cooking school.
Cooking school, restaurant, wrote the cookbook, and wrote an 8-page publicity brochure to publicize her cookbook. She was a self-promoter.
Barbara, do you know how she died?
We don't know. In 1941, the Soviets were in Poland, and she and her husband, I'm sure, were trying to escape with many, many other people from Vilna. Nothing was ever heard about them after that, unfortunately.
Thank you so much, Barbara. It was great to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you, Melissa. Thank you so much.
That was Barbara Mazur, who along with Wendy Waxman discovered the Vilna Vegetarian Cookbook. Melissa Clark is food columnist at the New York Times and author of Cook This Now. Now you can find Fania's recipe for carrot schnitzel at splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. See you here next week. And in the meantime, let me leave you with this thought from Anne Bronte, who said, "A light wind swept over the corn, and all nature laughed in the sunshine." Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. We want you to consider thesplendidtable.org as your go-to source for great recipes, weekly e-newsletters, and download our podcasts. And be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Laura Kalibi. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.